before you know it, you're searching for a ton of radioactive material that's missing in New Jersey.
Good point. I wonder what other ham radio operators could say about it, as it was discussed by not only me, but other people too. Anybody has a comment? Enter if she is. Nobody. So the next one is N2XGN. 432 Park Avenue, New York City. Billionaire Road. And it is physics of $500 million lawsuit at 432 Park Avenue, New York City scraper. Now, what we know is that the building is located at Park Avenue between East 57 and East 56th Street at 432 Park. It is 96-story ultra-luxury condominium standing tall in one of the most prestigious neighborhoods in the world. Designer renewed by architect Raphael Vignoli at 1,396 foot, which is 425.5 meter structure, and it is one of the tallest residential towers in the Western Hemisphere. The Midtown East structure is an icon for Manhattan City Scrape, which is commanding views of Central Park to the Hudson River and far beyond, end of quote. Okay. So, it is a very thin, it looks like, building that could shrink. It could shrink 10 feet, 15 feet, 20 feet one way and 30 feet the other way. So if you are at the top of the floor, you could feel like you are in the boat during the storm. I'm joking. They have two identical 600-ton tune mass dumpers throwing at 1,396 feet above Manhattan at this building. Maybe Dr. Roy would like to describe how the dumper works. Dr. Roy?
Again, it's one of those things that I think you gotta see a picture of. I don't think you can just kind of explain how it offsets residents of buildings. Suffice it to say that building was screwed up from the get-go. The people in charge of building it supposedly made something like 1,500 errors in design. One of the guys being sued actually owns an apartment in that building, and he admitted that it's kind of scary when it shakes. So it's an example of even, you know, wealthy people can be taken advantage of. Not easily, and they're going to try and get their money back, but still, they paid handsomely for a death trap, basically.
Yeah, so interesting. So actually, there are many owners of the apartment floors, the union floors in that building, but the only one is living there. And everything started from when the building waves, it's quick. And if somebody spent $250 million for apartment, he doesn't want to have a discomfort of squeaking. Now the dumper is actually 600-ton weight that is located next to the top of the building, and it is tuned the way that it's supposed to. If there is a swing, it stops, it not really stops the swing, but make the swing dissipate faster. So it is still swinging. Now imagine if there is some sort of construction failure. 600 ton of weight is going to fall down somewhere near that building. So right now the owners of the apartments in that building jointly decided that they want to place $500 million lawsuit for the damages plus all of the costs related to it, which we assume would be at least $200 million. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
Yeah, one of the YouTubes that I watched explained it, that the suit was for about $250 million in just that they want, plus they want penalty fees and lawyers' fees. And, you know, all these guys have lawyers that make more money than they do, probably. So it may come to something like half a billion dollars. But it's a kind of a gross mistake of engineering. Anyone or everyone that had anything to do with the building of that building should hang their head in shame, because they screwed up on 1,500 errors. That's a lot of errors for such a very expensive, really high real estate value land building. So this will go down in the history books every so often. Engineers and builders and promoters and financiers just make a lot of errors. And gosh, did they make a lot of errors with this one.
Now, in addition to that, that weight that is mounted very high up next to the top of the building is suspended in the air. It is not standing on any floor. It's suspended, and it is calculated that let's say 25 feet or 30, even 30 feet, you could probably find, because I don't remember exactly, there were some sources that say it is swinging 50 feet, but I don't believe it. So that swing creates movement of that weight, balancing weight, and is dumping the vibration faster than it would, and not preventing from that tower to get more swing that the structural the integrity could withhold. Back to you.
It's a resonant dampener. It acts as a pendulum swinging against the natural resonance when the wind blows past the building. So it's supposed to attenuate the resonant frequencies with an internal pendulum sort of going in the opposite direction. But you know, it can only go so far and do so well. Unfortunately, it isn't dampening that particular structure correctly. And so not only is it making noise that would annoy me, it's moving back and forth that would really annoy me. I like to have a building that doesn't move. A couple of times in the last 10 years, we had these small little seismic shock on Long Island, and it's not fun when the floor below you is moving, and you know you're not on some kind of mechanism that it's supposed to move.
I found some description. 432 Park Avenue, fascinating building and engineering marvel. This luxury high-rise apartment that billionaires wrote. Stands 96 stories, 140 units, including penthouses, for the 91st floor to the 96th floor. There are some incredible apartments currently for sale. Some of them as low as $135 million and $169 million. And amazing Japanese inspired apartment or whatsoever, Saudi billionaire Rayan Serhant, and whatever the lease of it. Back to you, Antonio.
Yeah, it sort of sounds like it was written, the review was written by the same guy who did the review for the Tar Heel antennas.
I love your comment, Dr. Reed. I love it very much. Thank you.
Well, I mean, that's the point. This is marketing BS, and we're all familiar with marketing BS. It makes Manhattan go around. So, you know, I mean, this is just what everyone does. Everyone promotes whatever they have. You know, if it's a turd, they shine it up, and they put it on sale for, 10% off, or, 9.99 instead of $10 or something. It's capitalism. God bless it. You know, I mean, that's what goes on. But it's interesting to see that even super wealthy schnooks can be completely blind to the same nonsense that probably added up to some of their own wealth. So it went around and it smacked them on the head. Couldn't happen to a nicer group of people.
I can only imagine the guy on the top floor in the building that is swinging 50 feet left and right or in any direction. Of course, I'm not sure about that 50 feet, but it's okay. It's okay. It's whatever it is, whatever they say. And to exchange.
Yeah, I don't think it's 50 feet. 50 feet sounds pretty much ridiculous. Probably with that amount of material fatigue, the whole damn top would tumble after a short while. But I don't know. If you were being bounced back and forth at 50 feet, to one side and to the other side with screeching noises and all kinds of things, that doesn't sound like you're a co-op owner. It sounds like you've landed in the first ring of hell.
Absolutely. Okay. OpenAI whistleblower Sudhir Balaji found dead by suicide in San Francisco apartment. Prior to his death, Balaji publicly accused OpenAI of violating U.S. copyright law with its generative AI app ChatGPT. The California native joined the artificial intelligence company as a researcher in 2022, but was quickly distributed by the workings of the image and text generation program. What he actually says is, at least what I understood from that, he was the one who created AI. Sachir Balyaji, 26, was found dead. I'm reading right now, November 26. San Francisco police officer who went to the apartment after being called to conduct check created the report. A medical examiner office ruled that there was no evidence of foul play and that his death is believed to be self-inflicted. So it's believed. Nothing to prove. It's believed. Dr. Roy, and to FCA.
Yeah, I think you said that he invented AI. He didn't invent AI. I'm sure he was a kind of intelligent guy, AI design is kind of bleeding edge. But unfortunately, a lot of very, very smart people have psychological problems. I would think it likely that he suffered from some degree of depressive disorder. And sometimes, unfortunately, that happens. There was a guy in England who was kind of the guy to go to for 3D printing. He was designing printer heads and all kinds of great things. He's relatively young, in his early 30s, and, you know, one night he killed himself. I don't think it had anything to do with 3D printing. I think, unfortunately, along with a very clever mind, was a fragile mind. So I think the same situation or something similar. Again, I would not kind of want to infer that some dirty business was afoot and he was silenced. There's almost $1 trillion riding on AI, so no matter what this guy said, he could stay alive for the rest of it, live to be 100 years old, and I don't think he could slow this this ball from rolling down the hill. So I'm sorry that that the gentleman unfortunately committed suicide. It's a waste of a smart brain that could be used to help society, but, you know, mental health is a situation that many people have had to deal with, unfortunately. It kills far too many people.
So that was my previous comment was based on the article, and then if we would try to think the way that you describe, we need to add some piece of information from the same article. On November 18, the New York Times filed a letter in federal court that named Balaji as a person with unique and relevant document that they would use in their current litigation against OpenAI, the Mueller report. Should I understand from that the New York Times sued them based on Balaji documents and Twixia?
The way you're reading it, it sounds like you're getting it from the Daily Mirror, which is not the New York Times, by far.
Hold on. No? New York Post. OpenAI whistleblowers Sudhir Balaji found dead by suicide in San Francisco apartment. Back to you.
The New York Post has been a rag since I was a small child. I would sooner believe the comics than the New York Post.
Okay. The last one. C1001 millimeter wave human detection sensors with ESP32 live detection, fall detection, sleep detection. So in other words, imagine that you have a motion detector in your house, in your alarm system. And that one, if you don't move, doesn't react. So you could stand forever in one place, and of course, if you look at the motion detector, it's not the trick with the photodiode that is there, or phototransistor that is inside, but with the lens. Lens is made from plastic and has thousands of lenses on it, like one on the top of the other, little bit up, a little bit down, and it creates the zone. So motion detector reads the infrared in the given area, and if something changes, it reacts. Now here we have something different. Let me jump. Okay. We have some sort of radar, that costs you only $40. And you can buy it on internet from different kind of companies. So I'm going to read the quote. Wave human detection sensors the small sensor has surprise PIR, which is motion detectors, and all other human body detection sensors. Because it uses 60 gigahertz operating frequency millimeter wave radar, which ordinary 24 gigahertz millimeter wave radars can only detect present speed and distance. That one can perform more advanced detection functions, like body detection sensor can recognize human postures using the point cloud imaging algorithm. It can accurately detect if somebody is standing or lying down. It can precisely perform live detection, how long the person stay in one place, and it can report if someone has fallen, and it could also detect body static state. The thing that is that surprised me, I'm reading the article, the most is ability to detect the body even if it's not moving. Many sensors fail here. If you were using motion detector, passive infrared PIR, then stop it. Because the C101-1001 millimeter wave radar don't let you move. Okay, whatever. Then it looks like a commercial there. But what surprised me is a 1.5 inch piece of PCB with the electronics on it, and it costs $40.00. And there is a link for it. So it looks like it could be used, because they also, the article say that motion detectors cannot be used in the bathrooms or private spaces like that. Well, it could. There is no regulation standing that they couldn't. And the article says that now you could use it rather 1 millimeter rather in such a place. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
Okay, this is passive infrared motion detectors have been with us for at least 30 years, maybe 40. I'm really into home control things, so I used to have passive infrared. I still have passive infrared because you can run it on a battery. Radar, and we pronounce it radar here, requires a lot more power, so you can't just put a battery in these units. You have to wire them up to your utility line, which adds a little bit more complication. Nevertheless, me being me, I already have a 24 gigahertz MM wave radar detection sensor. It also has a passive infrared sensor in the same small package, and it does unfortunately have to be plugged into a power supply because it would drain a battery very quickly. I've also played this particular 60 gigahertz microwave radar uses an ESP32 chip. I've played with ESP32 chips. So the problem probably at this point is it's a little too early that other people haven't really published drivers so that you could hook these things into your home control systems and get much out of it. So for early experimenters, have fun. Have a great time. Personally, you know, the difference to me between 24 gigahertz and 60 gigahertz isn't that much. 24 also will register a person if they're standing perfectly still because your heart is moving and it knows that. So that's what's going on with the microwave radar, that it's able to detect relatively subtle movements inside the human body.
As far as the power consumption, if the sensor is connected to the brain, which is the alarm system panel, it doesn't care about how much power it needs because the power is delivered. And I assume that some motion detectors would be in affordable price with 60 gigahertz, 1 millimeter frequency radar. I'm a little bit worried about privacy. Of course, I don't think it would be used outside because there are too many factors, and the wave could be bouncing off the branches of the trees whatsoever, and there would be snow, so I don't believe it could be used for outside of the building. It could only be used inside, unless there is a combo with passive infrared and the radar and some sort of intelligence in it. Back to you.
To KETD, test comment.
Yes, what's your comment, sir?
Oh, hey, I finally made it on. I think you guys are talking about, like, passive infrared. I recently watched a video of a guy who's a physical pen tester. He said that the microwave radars are actually very important to integrate with passive infrared for, like, request-to-exit sensors, because you can kind of spoof a request-to-exit by just, like, blowing something through. Like, if you turn a air can duster upside down and blow it, it'll trip the passive infrared, but it won't trip the microwave radar. Also, through AETV that happens.
Okay, I mean both passive infrared and radar have their benefits and their problems. You know, any kind of fluctuating source of heat can falsely trigger a passive infrared detector. There are ways to screw around with microwave radars. That's why I picked a unit that has both the passive infrared and the microwave, so that you can kind of figure out what's going on, and it lessens somewhat the false positives and such. So, and getting back to Wesley's, I wouldn't suggest the 60 gigahertz if you were at all intending to use it externally, because as you bring up the frequency of the radar, you're decreasing the range. So in a house, it would be fine. I think it's limited to about 11 meters. But, you know, on the outside, it would kind of run out of power, you know, the ability to actually do its stuff at a distance that most people would like to still have it work. But, you know, there are pluses and minuses for both. You know, someday there might be a technology that trumps both of them. Who knows?
Okay. There is something that I want to mention. The Sun SDR 2 Pro. Sun SDR 2 Pro. HF 6 meters and 2 meters. A transceiver. It's nothing new about it. Nothing to be especially pointed at. But ARRL, they have their channel, and they presented that SDR, supposedly Russian made, but working pretty good, and there are good comments on it. At least, whatever is available, despite some comments of users of that SDR, but for the knowledge, it costs $2,087, and it says unlimited available true back order. Well, if it's Russian, then after the war ends. And sanction ends. Anyhow, again, it's Sun SDR 2 Pro radio. Back to you, Doctor.
Yeah, I'm not terribly impressed. It came out a couple years, I think, after my Flex. My Flex uses programmable field gate arrays, which are, you know, they're basically software designable hardware. So you could actually configure the internal chipsets to be optimized for processing data the way that an SDR needs to process it, as opposed to the Russian one, which is built on an Intel chip, which, of course, they got from Intel because they can't make any chips themselves. So would I invest a dime in any kind of Russian equipment? No. But, you know, anyone out there, again, if it's their money, they can buy whatever they want, although I'm not even sure if it's legal to buy Russian transceivers. I don't know, but I'm certainly not going to invest anything. They didn't impress me when they first came out. They were kind of a generation old the first day that they were born, so be it.
KG2R Live, this is it.
Yes, David, we hear you. I put you on the list. I can't tell you, we're going to be wrapping this segment with Wes up, but there's a few, there's Brian comes before you, and then I have you listed because you emailed me, and then John.
Okay, I do my best to be there. You know, I think that people who know a lot about things, right? They know a lot about things, but the sound of the RF, it doesn't sound quite right. Maybe there's a way to fix it, you know, make it sound better. KG2RY.
Okay, we'll get to you later. Hopefully you'll be able to stick around. Give us a little time. Wesley, I think that's the last thing on your list for tonight.
Is it this? Thank you very much for the time given to me, and back to you, Dr. Roy, and to Xia.
And thank you for your participation, as always. Brian, are you out there? Because you're next on the list. So if you're out there, Brian, let me know.
This is Brian, CAF2ZZ, with a coin request.
Okay.
Is there any way that we could limit one person's discussion to no more than 15 minutes for the fairness of everyone?
Well, you know, other than basically having a buzzer go off and stop a guy, I don't really know how you can do that without being a little bit, less kind, if you will. And also, you got to kind of once again keep in mind that at the top of the TechNet, I asked for anyone who wanted to get on the list, and Wesley, who's always available, put his name up, and I then asked if there was anyone else, and I got crickets, and then I waited a little bit longer, and I asked again, and I got crickets, and then I said, you know, guys, if you're not going to ask any questions, don't tell me that you were upset with the guy who asked questions. So unfortunately, I think it's more polite generally if people just kind of try a little bit harder to show up at the beginning when we make up the list of who's going to do it. And Wes has always been kind and moved down the list as was necessary. So I think rather than just have a bell ring, I think people should kind of try a little bit harder to kind of come at the top of the technical net. And, you know, if you give me your name, I kind of know that Wes's comments and questions take a while to run through, so we usually kind of roll him down towards the end of the technical net. But if he's the only guy at the top, I can't put any other names because I don't have any other names.
Well, I think that's a fair and just response. May I state my question now?
Certainly. That's why I called your name.
What is the best way of estimating extreme conditions for, well, let me rephrase this. What would you say would be an excellent online resource in order to go ahead and predict the best propagation patterns for ionospheric skip worldwide on a real-time basis?
Offhand, I don't know of any real-time evaluation of the ionosphere based upon, I guess, sunspot activity, because that's the only thing you're going to base it on. Ultimately, I think the way that most amateur radio operators operate are on beacons and reverse beacons and DX clusters, reports of other hams, listening to web SDRs in different regions on the frequency that you're interested in, and seeing if your signal carries to that SDR. Methods like that. Research, as far as I'm aware, at least for the public, is not available in real time.
On QSL.net, that's not a portion of that website, actually, where you can get fairly real-time reports of, you know, basically where you are in propagation. But it's not, you know, obviously a true predictor. So the question that comes to my mind is, being that we're, what, about halfway through the sunspot cycle right now, what happens when the sunspot cycle changes? What should we expect?
Comment.
Yes, Leslie recognized. One sec, Leslie. Well, you'll get what happened the last time and the time before that and the time before that. As we go off, we're at the peak approximately. So as time goes on, the sunspot activity will get less and less, and there are sources on websites that give you the tally for the last day or so of, you know, the K value, the X value, all these lovely little values that every so often we talk about. But they don't necessarily correlate one-to-one. During the spring and summer, we had apparently a lot of geomagnetic storms that disrupted the ionosphere. So even though the solar flux and the solar and the sunspot activities were advantageous, you couldn't talk on 10 meters. So unfortunately, it's not as simple as looking up those numbers and getting absolute results. They're suggestive, but they're not definitive. What will happen as the sunspot activity declines is propagation conditions in F1 and F2 will be less and less energized. There'll be less propagation of 10 and 12 and 17 meters to a lesser degree 20 meters. So there'll be less refraction that will propagate your signal across the world. Instead, it'll start to just kind of go through the weak remaining F1 and F2 into outer space. And so your 10-meter conversations will be rather local, except for the occasional distant one as a fluke. And 80 will get a little bit less noisy, though, you'll find a little bit better use in 80 or 160, where sunspot activity is not a good thing. It tends to be detrimental. So, I mean, in a short spurt of an answer, that would be my answer for what we can expect to happen as the sunspot cycle goes into its decline.
I think that's a very good answer. Another question that came to mind that's very much on a similar topic, is there any way of directing a antenna with the use of either add-ons or something of that nature to direct more signal to the ionosphere directly and to see if that might help in terms of ionospheric skip or propagation?
Yeah, I mean, you can either design an antenna with a particular takeoff angle that would be more advantageous for the horizon based on your local topology, you know, if you got a clear mountain or hills or what have you. So, you know, it's probably better to design antennas to do that. You could add conductive material, which is effectively modified your antenna, even though it may not be attached directly to your antenna. Because think in terms of how Yagis work. You have a driven element that is hooked into your transmission line. The reflector behind it and the director ahead of it are parasitic elements that aren't connected by wire to your transmission line. So, you know, they're part of the antenna, but they're not part of the driven element of the antenna, if you get what I mean.
I do. I just wanted to see if there's anything that could be done with, let's say, an NFET wire antenna in terms of attaching something to it where it diverts part of the signal to the atmosphere. I don't know if that's just a simple way of looking at it, but just something that crossed my mind.
Yeah, I think there would be mechanical problems by adding other things on top of a half-wave NFET is already a rather lengthy, problematic, you know, I mean, you could kind of, you know, stick it to two points, you know, above ground and all well and good, but if you start to kind of add other elements to an NFET, it may help, but it probably wouldn't. It's probably more advantageous to change the orientation of the half-wave NFET. Because you can put little nooks, nicks, and you could slope it up, you could slope it down, you could go at a right angle. So you could modify the nodes of radiation that it puts out and possibly even affect its takeoff angle. It would be kind of difficult to tell what was going on. You could infer it by contacts that you make after the fact, but again, it's not like you could plug it into a simple equation and they'll tell you what the takeoff angle of your NFED that's twisted at five different points might be.
Very good, very good. Okay, last question, and then I'm going to free up the frequency for other people. Is there any way to electronically rotate a beam antenna? Not physically, but electronically.
Well, the best example, which almost none of us can really afford, we talked about it a few months earlier. There's a company called Stepper IR, which uses stepper motors and changes the actual physical length of the elements according to the stepper motor. So there is a setting for their stepper Yagis where you can electromechanically, I guess, you can reverse its direction by simply changing the reflector to act as a director and the director to act as a reflector. There are also some antennas where you can change the connection site, which changes some of the characteristics. You know, a cubic where one connection is opposite sides and the other one is right next to each other. So it's also electromechanical. So I think that's the closest I can give you to that type of operation.
Okay. It's like you have in a car, you have two adjustments for seating. Let's say number one and number two. Could you press a button for, let's say, one particular band to optimize, and then position two, where electromechanical methods are used to deform and reform the antenna into a different type of structure in order to go ahead and take advantage of that so the unit doesn't have to be turned necessarily?
Well, again, yes, but in practical terms, I cannot really come up with a good engineering example of electrically rotating a Yagi without the stepper motor situation, because effectively what makes these parasitic elements either reflectors or directors are their size relative to the driver. So you somehow have to change in some way the effective length of the parasitic elements in a Yagi to rotate it 180 degrees. So, you know, if you have some kind of electromechanical method to accomplish that, then it will work. But you know, the devil is in the details.
Understood, Troy. Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for answering my questions. I really appreciate it. Now I'm going to free up the frequency and just be on the side. Thank you so much.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Brian, as always, for participating. I always look forward to your questions. They're always interesting. You know, sometimes people ask the same question year in, year out, because it's a good question, but I like the fact that you come up with new ones.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your support. And this is KF2ZZ on the side.
Okay, very good. David, you're up next. If you're around. I get the idea that David stepped away. We'll try one more time. David, are you out there? Okay, let's move on to John, N2ZC. What can I do you for tonight, John? Okay, John doesn't seem to be on Echo Link, so either he got thrown off at some alley, something went kaboom, or just he's somewhere else. So anyway, once again, I'm AC2GS. David, are you back yet? Okay, well, once again, AC2GS here. AC2GS asking if anyone has any questions, comments, or topics for discussion tonight, because our last two people kind of are doing something else someplace else. So anyone have any questions or comments? Please hit that push to talk.
I have one.
ZM, Jaden. I'm just wondering exactly what I walked into, and I wanted to apologize for jumping in before. I didn't realize that this was a mess or something going on. I also do have a quick technical question.
Okay, Brian, we'll get right back to you. What's your name, sir?
My name is Jaden.
Okay, yeah, this is a regularly scheduled net every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on W2VL. It's been going on in one form or another, in one repeater or another, and one net control operator or another for 43-plus years. If you got a question, feel free. Let me hear it.
Yeah, sure. All right, cool. Thanks. So I just picked up a little Yaesu FT-1500M. It's my first, like, proper mobile radio, other than that I really only went to HF, and kind of install it in my parents' car without drilling any holes. I was just wondering what the best, what, like, can I just close the door on, like, RG-174? Do you think I can just, like, run RG-68 through the cracking door? Like, do you have any experience installing radios in a non-permanent way in the car?
Personally, no, but, There are ways to get around it. I have heard people talk about kind of sticking it between the door in such a way as, because, you know, doors are not airtight, and they usually have seals on them. And if it's a sturdy enough a coaxial cable, you can go through the seal without destroying the coax. Depends upon the make and model of the car and the size of the coax cable. relatively short runs of RG-58 aren't going to introduce that much loss. It depends upon how much power you want to transmit and what frequency you want to transmit, but there are a lot of people who've told me that they basically run the cable, through the doorway. There are different ways to kind of minimize pressure points and such.
Oh, okay, cool. I think that checks out. What if I, I'm a little bit worried. I right now have it closing on some RG-58, but you think, would I lose that much if I put, RG-174? And I'm, right now, this radio goes up to 50 watts, but I'm just running it at 90.
Well, I mean, it depends. Ultimately, it depends upon, in addition to your power handling, what your frequency range is. If you're interested in HF, you could have thinner coax. The point of thinness and thickness is kind of determines both the attenuation loss as you get higher and higher frequency and the power dissipation as you increase the power output to the transmitter. So, I think the smallest that I would deal with mobily would be RG-58, but I'm sure there are people who have tried even thinner coaxial cables, and they certainly are easier to thread the needle. Whether or not you might end up with some kind of waste heat loss because there's only so much power handling capacity. You also got to keep in mind that even though theoretically your transmitter is, 50 watts, if you're going to operate something like single sideband, it's not going to put out anything close to that. That's the maximum power rating. The duty cycle is much, much, much smaller.
Okay, yeah. I'm really only looking at, doing FM on 2 meters and maybe 70 centimeters because of a 70 centimeter radio for the car, from within the car. All of my HF stuff is so not really too worried about that. But I think that makes a lot of sense. So yeah, thank you. I'm going to head out for the night, so thank you, so you see the end clear.
Okay, very good. Glad to have you here. We're here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, so if you ever have a question or a comment to make, feel free to check in. So thank you for your participation tonight. Okay, back to you, Brian. What was your new question?
Well, I want to ask you a question, being that you're a physician. Have you ever seen any patients with progeria?
No. I would imagine that 99.9% of all physicians who have seen that would be pediatricians. I'm an adult general internist.
Understood. Since I was very young, I was very fascinated by this genetic disorder. And I know they have a treatment for it with an Ofarmid. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But it's a fascinating illness where the body basically ages tremendously in a shorter amount of time. And I just wanted to know if there have been any further treatments or any further research that can reverse this or shed some light on perhaps even reversing the aging process.
Yeah, I think people have kind of taken the ball and run way too far away. It mimics aging. It's a degenerative genetic disorder in which cell metabolism ultimately fails much earlier in an organism's, a human being's lifetime. So it's not that they're actively aging, and that if you find the cure for children who are actively accelerated aging, you'll slow down and or stop adult aging. It just mimics a lot of the similar degenerative changes as our ability to rebuild structures and cell lines kind of get screwed up as we get older and older and older. So I don't think it's the ultimate key for immortality, because I don't think it is really aging per se, but something that mimics it in many ways, but not in other ways. Like if it was truly just kind of an accelerated aging process, you would kind of think that you know, your growth would be accelerated as well, and you'd just, you know, by the time you're 3 years old, you'd be 6 feet tall, and then, you know, a couple years later, you'd start the gray hair and stooped shoulders, and a couple years later, you'd kind of be sitting there staring at a wall someplace. Whereas that's really not the presentation for this disorder. It's more that just stuff just keeps falling apart in them, unfortunately.
Understood. What's fascinating about it is that you say it mimics, and I'm just curious, is that mimicking because of the protein that's produced, that progerian-like protein, is that found in humans as they age?
Not to my knowledge, but, you know, I mean, I'm certainly not a specialist in this particular field. There's a lot of things that occur over a person's lifespan. The ends of DNA get whittled away every time they replicate, so that's an aspect of cell aging. There's byproducts that in young cell lines are more easily cleared than older. And so you get a lot of cells that kind of have junk in them that serve no effective positive purpose. So there's, again, you know, like cancer. Cancer is not one disease. Cancer is a couple hundred different diseases, and that's one of the many reasons why it's so difficult to deal with. So the aging process is a massive number of things that are quietly just going wrong in different ways on different levels throughout the cells that make up our body.
KG2RY.
Hello again, David. I called you a couple times. I guess you stepped away.
I'm all bossed on. Sorry about that. But I wanted to make a comment on what you're talking about now.
Okay.
Good experiences with supplements. One called Kidney Cleanse, made of cranberry extract. You're talking about junk that's in the cells of the body. Well, you know, this supplement, it gives me so much more strength and metabolism. Strange that a supplement can do that.
Yes, that is very, very strange. Cranberry juice is a acidifier of urine and makes a urinary tract infection less likely. It's a part of a regimen for some people with chronic urinary tract infection. By acidifying their urine, it makes it less advantageous for the organisms, and so they don't grow as fast, and they don't reinfect the bladder. Why cranberry juice should be your version of spinach that Popeye used to take, I don't know.
No, I think that the cells in the kidneys, you know, they collect a lot of gunk. It gets caught in there. Maybe it is clogged up, you know. And when it's clogged up, the kidneys can't function normally. So as a result, the body also has this problem. So this was what I deduced from it. I said, well, you know, I'll try these capsules and see. And I take one at night before I go to bed, and the difference is amazing, amazing, amazing.
Okay, it's kind of a misunderstanding of how kidneys work. Kidneys don't really metabolize things that much. The liver is primarily the detoxifier by way of incorporating it inside its cells and then metabolizing the